This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look back at Attorney General Eric Holder's record.
This isn't a record he should be proud of, but we'll tell you about it.
We'll also hear part of a presentation by Professor Catherine Franke on academic freedom and political dissent.
Rather than go to the University of Illinois, which she refused to do after the firing of Stephen Salada, she held a forum off campus about the very subject of his firing and academic freedom.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week, former Guantanamo Bay detainee Mozan Beg walked free from jail after several terrorist charges linked to the civil war in Syria were dropped. What happened?
I tell you, Heidi, I woke up last week in the morning and I got the news that Mozan Beg's case was dismissed by the prosecution. In fact, he was acquitted by the judge. The prosecutor came into court and said, we don't have sufficient evidence to prove the case. And new evidence has revealed that he essentially was wrongly charged, and not those words exactly, and he was considered acquitted of the, quote, terrorism charges, which had to do with him being at a training camp in Syria and I think purportedly buying a generator, I think for someone who was in a wheelchair. For myself, it was an extraordinary piece of news. First, Mozan Beg had been a long-term client of the Center for Constitutional Rights. He was one of our earliest Guantanamo detainees. He was in Guantanamo for at least 2 or 3 years. He was released, I think, approximately 2005, went back to England, eventually got a big settlement from the English government, as did a number of other Guantanamo British detainees. Of course, unlike the U.S., which has not settled with any of the Guantanamo detainees. I've spent time with Mozan Beg, been on his radio show in London. I traveled to Norway with him, where we watched a film on the claimed Guantanamo suicides, which, of course, we all believe were not suicides at all. So I knew him quite well. I was quite shocked when he was arrested by the British, put into Belmarsh Prison, spent 7 months there until his release last week. I attended the bail hearing. He was not given bail. That was about 3 months ago. And the prosecutor went on and on about him being a flight risk, which was absurd. His brother-in-law put up his house for him. They actually don't bring the defendants to those kind of hearings in Britain. He was on a video link from Belmarsh Prison. The trial was scheduled to go this October, very soon, sometime mid-October perhaps. And as a complete shock. The prosecutor
said there was no evidence?
The prosecutor said this. Since Mozan was arrested about 7 months ago, the prosecution states that they have kept under review the sufficiency of the evidence in the case. And here's what they said. The prosecution have recently become aware of relevant material and in light of which, after careful and anxious consideration, have reached the conclusion that there is no longer a realistic prospect of conviction in this case. The prosecution therefore offers no evidence. The judge responded, on the indication of the Crown offering no evidence, verdicts of not guilty should be entered. Beg had been charged with 7 counts, which I, Michael Ratner, have just described, and he was released from Belmarsh Prison almost immediately. There's pictures of him in his car being taken out of Belmarsh with his solicitor, who I work on a number of cases with, Gareth Pierce, who is Julian Assange's solicitor as well. It is a pretty amazing shock, because if you look at Mozan's life, that means twice he's essentially been imprisoned because of being an activist Muslim. Once at Guantanamo for a couple of years, this one for just over a half a year. His statements when he came out on leaving jail, Mozan said, I wanted my day in court, but I was very happy. He went on to say, I need to reconnect with my family again. I need to understand what it's like to be a free man, and I think that is important to point out some of the government's failures in its foreign policy and its internal policy. It is clear it's demonizing the Muslim community. And then he says, and not once, but twice in my case, This government has been involved either indirectly or indirectly detaining me. I think it shows we have a knee-jerk reaction. Little has changed since the beginning of the early days of the war on terror, and there is not an appetite, there isn't a desire to try to really understand what's taking place. And the more this continues, the more it's going to alienate people. So it was an important day for Mozem Beg, and perhaps an important day for ending some of the demonization of Muslims.
Do we have any updates related to Guantanamo? It's been a while.
I wish we did, Heidi. We have the same update, which is Guantanamo remains. Guantanamo is still there. That orange jumpsuits that we have put Guantanamo people in are still emblematic and a symbol to the Muslim world of everything the U.S. has done wrong in terms of Muslims. To remind our listeners, there's still 149 people, 149 inmates, in Guantanamo. Of that 149, 79 are approved for transfer. 79 have been there almost, some of them, 12, 13 years. They, even according to our own government, shouldn't be there. And despite Obama's promise to close Guantanamo within 1 year of his administration, he has failed to do that. There are 60 others who have never been charged. They're in what they call a continue-to-detain status, no charges. So the answer is, sadly, Guantanamo is still there. What it stands for in our world is still there. The idea of forever detention, established by Bush, continued by Obama, is still there. So we've had no positive results. And then I came across a very depressing headline today, although I think it's not completely accurate. What it does say is Guantanamo closure plan stalled at Pentagon. Well, that article is trying to say that Secretary Hagel, who has to certify each Guantanamo detainee for release, is refusing to do so or holding it up. But of course, he works for President Obama. So if President Obama wanted these people released, he simply has to direct Secretary Hagel to do so, like he certainly did when they released five Guantanamo detainees to get Taliban out of Guantanamo and send back to Afghanistan. So each one has excuses. The president has excuses of Congress. Congress has excuses of the president. Hagel has excuses that he makes. So the president won't look bad. In the end, all three branches of our government are branches of the same tree. They aren't planning to close Guantanamo anytime soon. So, Heidi, I understand our six-year Attorney General, Holder, has resigned 2 years before the end of the Obama administration. Heidi, why don't we talk a bit about Attorney General Holder's career?
Well, Michael, it's so easy for us to just slip right into the criticisms of Holder. But before we do that, let's look at one or two good things that happened while he was heading the Department of Justice. He recently addressed the Brennan Center for Justice here in New York and announced the federal prison population has dropped by approximately 4,800 inmates since a year ago. This is the first time that an inmate population federally has fallen as opposed to risen over a fiscal year since 1980.
That is extraordinary, Heidi. That's 34 years. We've had no drop in our federal prison population. Our federal prison population, as you and I are aware, is about a little over 200,000, 210,000 or so. So that means we've had a not 1% drop, we've had a 2% drop. And I think it's very lucky those 4,800 people, assuming they walked away, are probably pretty happy. But look at it this way, Heidi. If you had 100 pennies and you lost two of them, would it really make any difference?
Point well taken, Michael. But listen to this. Holder also made inroads in mandatory sentencing reforms for nonviolent drug offenses. That was a big issue in New York. There was some movement made on that front.
How much movement do we know?
Well, at least it reversed a trend. I think that's what's important. And you can't deny that Holder defended the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act when it was under attack in the courts.
He wasn't a zero. He was negative in many ways, negative zero. You know, this has been going on for a long time. We've had a long struggle in this country about nonviolent drug offenses. And this is the only the tip of the
Rockefeller drug laws have been horrible.
Michelle Alexander's book on the new Jim Crow.
Right.
So this is probably the equivalent of, you know, a drop in the bucket. That's my guess.
Right.
But it's a drop in a bucket that had been empty, perhaps, until then.
So it's
I think he could have been a lot bolder. That's my guess.
I agree.
So I wouldn't give him a lot of credit.
Okay, let's talk one final positive that he's done. He has brought more investigations than has happened in a long time of police departments across the country and entered into a couple of consent decrees, including with New Orleans. That's important.
The people in New Orleans were happy to see them come down, happy to see them do that. He's been certainly better on police misconduct in police departments. I think that's right.
Right. And I think that's especially true because he cares about racial tensions and easing those. Now, let's go to the negative list. He's approved the drone killing of...
Before we go to the negative list?
Yes.
We want all our listeners to take out a sheet of paper and number from 1 to 100 because we can probably come up with 100 things on the negative list. We won't do it here, all of them. You can fill in the list and send them in to lawanddisorder.org.
Let's start. This one I know you care about. Holder approved the drone killing of Anwar al-Awlaki, an American in Yemen.
Pretty amazing. I mean, that's incredible. He executed an American without due process. And I think it's either he or Obama said, well, due process is what we say,
Holder,
not the courts.
Okay. Holder addressed Northwestern University Law School in 2012. Arguing, as you said, that the Obama administration had the right to kill U.S. citizens who belong to al-Qaeda or associated forces. And he made this statement. I'm quoting, "Some have argued that the president is required to get permission from a federal court before taking action against a U.S. citizen who is a senior operational leader of al-Qaeda or associated forces. This is simply not accurate. Due process and judicial process are not one and the same, particularly when it comes to national security. The Constitution guarantees due process, does not guarantee judicial process." That's Holder.
Sometimes one act can wash away every other, potentially decent deed you've ever done in your life. This one undercuts the very foundations of our lives, of due process, of our security of person, by saying the executive, in this case in the person of Holder, can simply bypass the courts and kill an American.
Exactly.
Well, there you go. Mr. Kill Drone Holder.
Kill Drone Holder also, speaking of torture, failed to prosecute any of the Bush administration officials for their unlawful acts. Now, we know there was a rare chance that would happen, but it would have sent a huge symbolic message.
You know, we put a lot on him, but of course they were all in cahoots together to not prosecute these guys. Obama was right up there. They got pressure from the CIA, which they were unwilling to resist. But of course, Holder is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, and it was his job to go after those people who were the torturers. We had openly admitted torturers. We had Cheney saying, "I'd do it again." Bush, likewise. We had you and Bibi who wrote the memo supporting it. And then we had the torturers themselves. So we had three levels of people that Holder could have gone after. How many did he go after? None.
Zero.
And so now we're not left with not just the guilty not being punished, but we're left with torture still being considered a viable political or legal option, one in which people just are arguing about does it work or doesn't it work,
right,
rather than saying it's unlawful, it's illegal, and it's a crime against the fundamental norms of our civilization.
That's right. And the longer it goes unaddressed, Michael, I think the unfortunately, the more it becomes mainstreamed in the society.
It's a very dark time. Thank you again, Mr. Drone Torture Holder.
Check. Next, who approved the NSA's mass surveillance programs, Michael?
Actually, I don't even know. Heidi.
Well, we don't know.
Who are we talking about here?
We're still talking about Holder. He, as head of the Justice Department, could have intervened and said, maybe I'm naive in thinking this, but he could have said, you know, this blanket prison program and the many other things that the NSA and other intelligence agencies are doing violate the letter of the law.
Violate the Fourth Amendment.
And the Fourth Amendment.
Violate other statutes. But what did Mr. Drone Torture Holder do in this case?
Nothing.
So we now have another name?
And I have a theory. My theory is leading up to the next big problem with Holder. And this is...
So I should hesitate for
hesitate before
drone
the names.
Torture.
Mr. Financial Fraud Holder. Abrogated responsibility in the area of holding corporate criminals accountable. Wall Street. He came in right after the financial disaster. No executive, no firm has been held accountable for the Wall Street crash and for the widespread financial misdeeds that led us to the worst recession in seven decades, Michael.
No bankers indicted?
Hello?
Nobody from J.P. Morgan?
More than that.
Isn't that where he's going to work?
Michael.
You mean to say that he didn't indict any of the people? And yet he's going to work for one of them now?
I'd like to quote from him again. He said, I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we're hit with indications that if you do prosecute, if you do bring a criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy. And then he says his famous line, I think it's a function of the fact that some of these institutions have become too large. Now, he presided over the HSBC scandal and settled with HSBC for $2 billion. The bank was caught laundering money for drug cartels, and there was no criminal prosecution. So I think you've answered the question. It's because his new job. And I would say there's a link between this and the mass surveillance, that Holder didn't prosecute the big financial institutions because he had such a cozy relationship in terms of NSA spying and the exchange of our personal information, which has become commodified. So these are his best buddies.
Now we have to think of more adjectives to put into his name, but we're
getting
a lot
now. It's a long name.
But it is interesting that he's going to work for one of the very banks.
It is interesting.
That was not indicted.
Yeah. Chase. Some people who support Holder would say that the DOJ did bring and settle civil cases with several banks.
They did.
Yeah. J.P. Morgan, $13 billion settlement. Citigroup, $7 billion. Also Bank of America, $17 billion. But for a bank, as you said, with the prison stats, it's kind of a drop in the bucket.
No, it barely shows up on their balance sheet.
And then with settlements, as our listeners probably know, there's no admission of wrongdoing.
Right.
So
what would you say? We have more on them, I'm sure, but...
We almost forgot the most kind of important to us is the area of whistleblower prosecution. While he hasn't prosecuted the big banks that ruin the lives of many Americans, he has gone after those brave individuals, the whistleblowers, who have brought to the public fore information that we otherwise wouldn't have known about in terms of government corruption.
This is true. Now, Chelsea Manning, of course, was prosecuted by the military.
Right.
But there was a WikiLeaks grand jury we still believe might be sitting in the Eastern District of Virginia. They openly have said just recently that the Department of Justice, that's what Mr. Holder headed until a few days ago, that they have an open investigation in their national security and criminal divisions against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. They, of course, have issued a criminal complaint against Edward Snowden in Moscow, who's sitting in Moscow. They, of course, are continuing this prosecution of whistleblower Sterling and going after
James Risen.
James Risen of the New York Times, who they're trying to force to disclose their source. And
for his book, State of War.
For his book, State of War. And in addition,
and exposing the warrantless wiretapping under the Bush administration.
Right. That they went after all that.
Yep.
Now let's think about what else has happened recently on the whistleblower issue. Remember, there was a subpoena issued to a Fox News reporter
yes.
for all his records,
mm-hmm.
and they basically lied in that subpoena by saying he was, or maybe they didn't lie, maybe they really thought this is a co-conspirator of his, with his source, and that therefore we get these records. Then remember, they subpoenaed all these telephone records from the AP.
Yes.
Then they supposedly instituted mm-hmm. new guidelines. This all happened under, would you want to call him free information holder? No.
No, he's not free information holder.
He's hold the information
he's
holder.
He's withholding information. Withholder.
So that's actually really important. Because if you look at my client, Julian Assange, has been very subjected to what Holder has done, as has Jeremy Hammond, who's serving a 10-year prison sentence for the hack, the alleged hack into Stratfor, the private intelligence
right.
company.
Yeah.
So it's not been a good record for Holder.
And Michael, let's not forget on a personal note, our colleague and dear friend Lynn Stewart was resentenced at the insistence of the Department of Justice because they felt that Judge Codal's initial sentence of, I think it was 2.5 years, was far too lenient. So she was resentenced to 10 years, but fortunately is out on compassionate release. But that was another stain on the Department of Justice.
It's true. That was Attorney General Holder, again, pushing one of our friends into prison for a number of years.
One of the most important social movements we saw, the Occupy movement. We know that the Department of Homeland Security, with the Justice Department coordination, worked hand in hand with local businesses, local financial institutions, and local law departments to really clamp down and shut down Occupy.
I think that's right. They were instrumental in doing that. So I don't think it's been a good 6 years for Holder.
You know, if we were to grade him and if we were to be teachers, I would give him an F, Michael.
I would, too. I would fail him.
I would flunk him out.
Because I don't really believe in prisons. I probably wouldn't right. send him to prison.
Right.
But, you know, I'd put him into internal exile somewhere. Anyway, goodbye, Mr. Holder.
Goodbye, Mr. Holder.
Unfortunately, I don't have expectations that anyone better will come along.
No.
Because he, like other people in this administration, are products of this administration, this country, and the politics of the country.
That's right.
And he never rose above them.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Part of our continuum. continuing coverage of Professor Stephen Salata's case and concerns under established principles of academic freedom, we hear a presentation by Catherine Franke, professor of law at Columbia University. Listeners may recall that Professor Salata was unhired from the American Indian Studies program at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign because of his statements on social media criticizing Israel's conduct of military operations in Gaza. Last month, we reported that scholars across the country issued a letter condemning the decision of the university to unhire the professor. Catherine Franke discussed the case at the University of Illinois late last month. The presentation was titled Academic Freedom and Political Dissent, a conversation with Catherine Franke and the community. Let's take a listen.
So I'm here sort of by accident, and tragically by accident, but delightfully so. And I'm here to stand with you in outrage, and an outrage at the assault on academic freedom that Professor Salata's termination represents. I'm also here to help frame some of the issues that are at stake in the case at this moment, at this pivotal moment, after the Board of Trustees have voted. And I'm here to engage this vibrant, thrilling, really, intellectual community as you find yourselves in the eye of a storm that has touched almost every one of our campuses across the country. Your struggle is our struggle, and that's why I'm here, and that's why so many other scholars and students and activists around the country, and really around the globe, have stood with you through this, and we will remain with you. You are not alone, although I know it feels isolating being here, particularly with the boycott, but you are not alone. I'm here to tell you that you are not alone also in confronting the work of a very well-financed, well-organized, and powerful set of groups that seek to cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom. These are the words of Justice William Brennan, a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom. An orthodoxy regarding the conflict between the Israelis and the Palestinians, an orthodoxy regarding the meaning and consequences of certain forms of state violence in the Middle East, and an orthodoxy regarding complex claims of dispossession, belonging, and identity, both here and in the land to be found between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. This pall of orthodoxy at its core undermines fundamental values of academic freedom, but more than that, it threatens the academic project more generally. So we stand here tonight, myself and my colleagues here, exactly a week after the university's Board of Trustees voted 8-1 not to approve the nomination of Professor Stephen Salata for an appointment with tenure on this outstanding faculty. So what now? What are the longer-term implications of the catastrophe that we witnessed in the Board of Trustees, the trustees' boardroom last week? So I come to this question in three ways, with three hats, and I don't know how to wear three hats at once, so I'll shift them in an imaginative way. The first is as a law professor and a civil rights lawyer. The second is as an academic who's made a career out of unsettling, comfortable notions of identity, comfortable notions of justice, and a kind of convenient idea that the law stands as an alternative to violence. Lastly, I come to you as a scholar of Palestine and of Israel. So in my first capacity as law professor and as lawyer, I want to say a few things about the law. Law school is now in session for a short time. I want to talk to you about the law of free speech and of academic freedom, and of the constitutional right of a professor to speak his or her mind both inside and outside of the classroom. So let me start with a conclusion. A conclusion about the strength of Professor Salita's case, legal case, against the university for the actions that they took last week. In my view, as a professor of law and as a civil rights lawyer for over 30 years, he will win if and when he files a lawsuit challenging this university's actions. He will. In this view, this is not just my view, in this view, I've been joined by scores of constitutional law professors. We wrote a letter to the university explaining why this was an easy case. Many of them disagree vehemently with the content of Professor Salaita's scholarly work and his tweets, but they all were in unanimous agreement that he cannot be punished or retaliated against on the basis of those tweets as a core principle of free speech and academic freedom. So most of you are not lawyers, so allow me to give you a little summary of why I think this is an easy case. First, as a simple matter of employment law, Illinois law is quite clear that he has a claim for a breach of an employment contract. Now, I won't ask you to endure a real law school-like lecture on the fine points of promissory estoppel or detrimental reliance. It's, you know, after seven, you'd be asleep so fast, you wouldn't even know it. So you're just going to have to take my word on it that this is a strong claim. But the constitutional questions, of course, are more pressing, more complex, and quite frankly, much more interesting. So the First Amendment's free speech clause was designed to prevent precisely what happened here. A state entity, in this case, the trustees of a public university, cannot refuse to hire and cannot fire an employee on account of the content of his speech on a matter of public concern, period. End of argument. They may disagree with his viewpoint. They may even find his viewpoint troubling or offensive. But if he's otherwise qualified for that appointment, which we know he is and was, after being vetted by your faculty and your provost, the university's board of trustees may not refuse to hire him on the basis of his speech, period. This is a textbook violation of the First Amendment's free speech clause. To be honest, this case wouldn't even work well as a law school final exam question because the right answer is so obvious. And I'm always looking for new things to use as exam questions. This one won't work, thankfully. So the Supreme Court has found in case after case that the right to free speech secured by the First Amendment has particularly important purchase in the academic context. In fact, many, many of the Supreme Court's landmark free speech cases have involved threats to the speech rights of educators. In few other precincts of society are First Amendment values more important and more dearly held than they are in the academy. So, my first slide, Carol Merrill. I'm gonna read you a little bit of law, and so that you can stay with me, I've got it on a couple of PowerPoints here. So the Supreme Court noted in a very important academic free speech case, and this is Justice Brennan. You wanna listen or do you wanna move? Okay. Our nation is deeply committed to safeguarding academic freedom, which is of transcendent value to all of us, and most not merely to the teachers concerned. That freedom is therefore a special concern of the First Amendment, which does not tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom. Such a fundamentally important idea. So the claims raised by Professor Salaita in a truncated 140-character fashion in his tweets and in a rigorous, careful, and academic way in his scholarship engage one of the most vexing human rights issues of the day, certainly one being debated across the globe in courtrooms, in various divisions of the United Nations, in legislatures and parliaments, in the media, and of course, in our classrooms and on our campuses. If we can't deliberate about these issues critically in an academic setting, where can we? American universities have been the home to vigorous political and philosophical debate and disagreement on issues such as racial justice, the Vietnam War, pornography, nuclear weapons, South African apartheid, U.S. foreign policy in Central America, Iraq, and Afghanistan, the rights of religious minorities, the rights of lesbians and gay men to serve openly in the U.S. military, and today, the relations between Israel and Palestine. This issue comes to our campuses as part of a long line of difficult, contested questions we've debated on our campuses. So now, the objection has been made, even by the members of the Board of Trustees, that the commitment that we see in this case and in this language from the Supreme Court to robust debate in the academic setting ends where the speech on one side becomes discriminatory, hateful, or hostile in such a way that it interferes with the learning environment for some students. The argument goes that the First Amendment right to free speech has a limit, and it reaches that limit when the speech in question is biased or bigoted in nature. This argument is just plain wrong, and it's wrong for two reasons. First, it's wrong as a matter of law. The Constitution's protection of speech rights protects all speech, even speech we might find odious or offensive. But more importantly, and this is so much at stake in this case, more importantly, this argument rests on an erroneous premise that any criticism of Israel is necessarily anti-Semitic in nature. This faulty premise, voiced over and over explicitly by members of your Board of Trustees last Thursday, confuses criticism of the actions of a state, in this case Israel, with hatred or bias toward the people who make up the majority in that state. That is the kind of facile and reductive argument that would never survive even the most cursory of examinations in an academic context. It is a lazy, polemical argument. For the Chancellor and the members of the Board of Trustees to countenance such an argument when making one of the most important decisions within their mandate, constituting an academic faculty, is, to be quite honest, shocking. Shocking. So let me give you another example that might further illuminate the ideological agenda that underwrites the reduction of criticism of Israel to always being anti-Semitic. One of my central academic projects over the last countless years, more than I'd like to count, has been a critical examination of the strategies of the same-sex marriage movement and lawyers. I've argued, largely against the grain of most opinion in the gay community, that prioritizing marriage equality is a terrible mistake. That's the lecture I was going to give. On campus, right? That it has transformed a radical sexual rights movement into an assimilationist, conservative, and sexist movement. So I've made this argument in a nuanced way on the pages of the nation's best law reviews and in a forthcoming book called Wedlocked. Shameless plug. And I've made the argument in very colorful, queer, and colloquial ways in speaking engagements and in my blog. It would be ludicrous to describe my criticism of the marriage equality campaign as homophobic in nature. I just have a very strong disagreement with the arguments that those advocates make, the power they wield, and the significance of the violence they cause to individuals and families whose lives don't line up easily and nicely in the marital form. My criticisms of marriage equality, well known on my campus, and it seems shared here with many of you, do not create a hostile learning environment for gay and lesbian students. They know I have a controversial voice on this issue. Some of them love it. Some of them think I'm nuts. Some of them tolerate me, and a substantial group want to know more. But all recognize that my position on this issue does not pollute my campus or the campuses where I speak with something we might recognize as homophobia. Criticism of the ideas and formations of power do not reduce always already to forms of bigotry and bias. Similarly, divisive issues permeate our campuses all the time, both inside and outside the classroom, from the question of abortion rights to gun control to immigration to the assertion of religion as a justification for an exemption from the Affordable Care Act's mandate to provide contraception to all employees. We don't run from discussion of these hotly contested issues. We engage them head on. That's what we do as academics. This deeply treasured value was put well by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis in 1927. When he observed that the best remedy to apply to speech we abhor is more speech, not enforced silence. Go, Justice Brandeis. This principle is nowhere more compelling than here in an academic context. So now, the University of Illinois, and just stop me by waving or snapping or something if I'm telling you things you already know and I'm boring you with it, but it's had other low moments. When it comes to threats to academic freedom, particularly when discussing controversial issues of the day. Fortunately for me, you have fantastic archivists and librarians here. And you've got a website that documents the history of threats to academic freedom on this campus. So you did my research for me. So I have two examples. I'm going to skip over the first one that has to do with anti-communist activities in the 40s. But the second is just much more fun. And this is about Professor Leo Koch, who was here in the 60s. He was a professor in your biology department, and he entered into a spirited, shall we say, debate in the Daily Illini after the paper had published an article that criticized heavy petting parties. So, despite protests that framed his termination as a violation of principles of academic freedom, the Board of Trustees, yes, upheld his termination. The university was then censured by the American Association of University Professors. Sound familiar? Rightly so. So just as Professor Koch was regarded as a sex radical, if not a pervert, because the other things he did when he left the university are less, more complicated, shall we say. But he was regarded as a radical and a pervert who was out of step with a particular view of sexual decorum held by university leaders in the early 60s. And so, too, those who refused to sign loyalty oaths repudiating communism were seen as dangerous radicals who threatened the hearts and minds of young Illinois students in the 1940s. Today, we face a similar controversy surrounding the positions taken by academics whose criticism of the politics of the State of Israel are out of step with the opinions of this university's leadership, some of its largest donors, and a powerful lobby that seeks to censure speech critical of Israel on college campuses. Back to the Supreme Court, they could not be clearer in condemning this kind of affront to academic freedom. So one last quote from Justice Brennan, it's a long one. In a case successfully challenging a similar statute to the one you had in Illinois, but ours was in New York, that prohibited subversives from employment as teachers in public schools. So Justice Brennan, one of our stars of on the Supreme Court defending the First Amendment, wrote that to impose any straitjacket upon the intellectual leaders in our colleges and universities would imperil the future of our nation. No field of education is so thoroughly comprehended by man that new discoveries cannot yet be made. Particularly is that true in the social sciences, where few, if any, principles are accepted as absolutes. What about the humanities? Anyway, maybe I hadn't heard of them, I don't know. Scholarship cannot flourish in an atmosphere of suspicion and distrust. Teachers and students must always remain free to inquire, to study, and to evaluate, to gain new maturity and understanding. Otherwise, our civilization will stagnate and die. This is the reasoning why Professor Salida's case is an easy case. So I project these quotes from the Supreme Court's free speech cases to suggest a poster campaign on this campus, plastering the walls with the words from the Supreme Court. They speak truth to power. But more than that, they speak power to power. So take these slides, put them on fun sort of old-timey posters, and put them all over this campus. I'll put them up on mine too. So what's taken place on this campus since early August when Chancellor Wise first informed Professor Salida that the finalization of his appointment was in jeopardy is not an isolated incident. It's part of a concerted, well-coordinated political strategy by certain defenders of Israel in general and of a particular form of political Zionism, particularly, that seek to purge, as I said before, the Academy of Scholars, Research, and Speech that defends the human rights and sovereignty of Palestinians. We've watched, I myself, very closely, similar witch hunts at Columbia, at Northeastern, at several campuses in the University of California system, and at a number of other schools where students have been punished and student organizations have been decertified on account of their speech that was critical of Israel or expressed some sympathy for the sovereignty interests of Palestinians. We've witnessed our provost being blanketed with pressure from outside actors to deny tenure to faculty up for promotion whose scholarship challenges a Zionist justification of the dispossession of Palestinians. And complaints have been filed with the Federal Department of Education by the Zionist Organization of America, alleging that some universities tolerate a hostile climate for Jewish students because the university did not censure student speech in favor of Palestinian rights. So not only does criticism of the State of Israel amount to anti-Semitism in this set of arguments, but sympathy for the plight of Palestinians so too is anti-Semitic in nature at its core. Just this week, in fact, the Department of Education dismissed such a complaint filed against Rutgers University, finding that exposure to such robust and discordant expressions, even when personally offensive and possibly hurtful, is a circumstance that a reasonable student in higher education may experience and should be or could be exposed to. Last year, the Department of Ed also dismissed the suits against similar complaints against of discrimination against the UC Berkeley, Santa Cruz, and Irvine. Part of the problem with these attempts to censure the students, the universities, and our scholarship, I think, is that it doesn't give our students enough credit. They can take it. They need to develop the critical skills to engage arguments they disagree with or find offensive. That's what we do as educators, is help arm them with those arguments. So the Salida case, lastly, raises two more issues that I'd like to briefly address before hearing from this amazing panel of local talent who know so much more about these issues than I. So apart from the threat to the well-established bedrock principles of free speech, the refusal to finalize Professor Salida's appointment raises a question of the relevance of faculty members' extracurricular speech. Speech on Twitter, speech on Facebook, perhaps speech here, particularly speech on matters of public concern, and the relevance of that speech to their suitability as a university instructor. In other words, what is the relevance, if any, of that faculty member's out-of-the-classroom speech to their fitness to perform in the classroom and to run a fair and rigorous classroom? More than that, does the revelation of a professor's political views outside the classroom have the potential to poison his or her reputation in a curricular context? So much so that some students would feel unwelcome in that class or in their classes. This is, in a way, what the indictment was of Professor Salida. So I take this bill of particulars seriously. So over the last few days, I've perused the website of the Federal Elections Commission and other sites that publicly disclose contributions that individuals have made to PACs and other nonprofits to understand what sort of donations members of your faculty and Board of Trustees have made to political campaigns and causes that they support. Because as we know from Citizens United, financial contributions to political campaigns is a form of free speech of the highest order that deserves the most robust protection under the First Amendment. You didn't expect me to cite Citizens United favorably. But let's put it to work. So here's what I found. Many of your faculty have made donations, lots of dollars, thousands of dollars to Barack Obama's presidential campaign and to the Democratic National Committee. So too, many, not as many, but many of your faculty have contributed to Republican political candidates. John McCain, George W. Bush, Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney. Remember those guys? One faculty member in the medical school gave tens of thousands of dollars to Lyndon LaRouche's presidential campaigns and PACs. You can look it up. I'm not going to name names. You probably know who these people are. Some of these candidates that faculty have strongly supported through the exercise of their First Amendment right to give money hold views that have been portrayed that I think actually are openly homophobic, openly racist, openly anti-Semitic, and AIDS-phobic, Lyndon LaRouche in particular. Other candidates for whom faculty have expressed strong support hold views that are hostile to the First Amendment, to the sanctity of human life, and to marriage as a sacred bond between a man and a woman, or one man and one woman. I've also traced the contributions that your faculty have made to political causes, such as pro-marriage equality and anti-marriage equality, pro-choice and anti-choice, in favor of stand-your-ground laws and against stand-your-ground laws. So just so you know, Chris Kennedy's FEC filings show that he's made substantial contributions to the campaigns of Evan Bayh, Mark Warner, Dick Durbin, Sheldon Whitehouse, John Kerry, Jesse Jackson Jr., Barack Obama, and Claire McCaskill, among other politicians in the region and nationally, as well as to a kind of ad hoc Democratic organization in his community on the North Shore of Chicago. He's also given very generously to a PAC that represents real estate interests, the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trusts, Inc. So what should we make of this kind of extracurricular speech by faculty and top administrators? Speech that could be conceivably create a hostile environment for gay students, female students, Christian, Muslim, Jewish students, or students of color on your campus. Or in the case of Kennedy's contributions, do they send a message that the University of Illinois is not a welcome place for conservative or Republican students? I don't hear a clamor that this kind of political speech threatens the suitability of these professors to teach in a fair, balanced, and rigorous way, or that Kennedy is capable of governing, or incapable, that is, of governing in a diverse university system, such as the University of Illinois. Nor do I hear that these strong views expressed by the faculty and leadership of the university through their giving indicate, as President Easter said in his remarks at the Board of Trustees meeting the other day, indicate that they would be incapable of fostering a classroom environment where conflicting opinions would be given equal consideration regardless of the issue being discussed. This strikes me as a moment where what's good for the goose, in this case Professor Salida, may be equally good for the gander, such as the other members of the University of Illinois faculty and its more particularly its administrative leadership. Chancellor Wise, by the way, does not give money away, that is at least registered by the Federal Election Commission. Do with that what you want. If anything is a bedrock of principle of the Constitution, it's that the First Amendment protects speech in the form of financial contributions to the political campaigns and causes of your choosing. It also protects your participation in debate on matters of public concern, whether in highbrow venues such as scholarly journals and books, or lowbrow venues such as Facebook or Twitter. By and large, the university has sought to parry the serious constitutional objections to their handling of the Salida appointment by taking the position that it did not refuse to hire him on account of his views on Israel, but on account of his tone. Right? You know this. Chancellor Wise declared essentially a new civility norm on campus and said that she will not tolerate comments that are disrespectful or actions that demean or abuse either viewpoints themselves or those who express them. she needs some help from the English department in some of the construction of these new norms so you know how to comply with them. Civility, it turns out, should be the governing norm here and unfortunately on a number of other campuses across the country. So let me say one thing emphatically. Whatever else civility may be, it is not an academic norm. Rigor is an academic norm. Even worse, the timing of the uptick in civility rhetoric by university leadership across the country is no accident. To those of us who've defended academic freedom on this issue in recent years, on the issue of Israel-Palestine, these new civility codes echo in profoundly disappointing ways the framing that's been advanced by political operatives who seek to capture the parameters of discussion of Israel and of Palestine in an academic context. This is their new strategy, advanced in a well-organized public relations campaign aimed at university executives. Portray criticisms of Israel as uncivil and purge Israel's critics from our universities on the ground that their ideas are out of place, misplaced, have no place in a context governed by an incivility norm. Last slide. As Oliver Wendell Holmes reminded us during the anti-communist purges in the 1920s and the 1950s, every idea is an incitement. Just love that. Every idea is an incitement. The only difference between the expression of an opinion and an incitement in the narrower sense is the speaker's enthusiasm for the result. Eloquence may set fire to reason. The Supreme Court does not write like that anymore. I join you, I join Professor Salida, and I join scholars in all of our universities in a solemn pledge to continue inciting a new generation of students with ideas that refuse an obedience to orthodoxy and that threaten to disorder settled notions of belonging, dispossession, and identity on this campus and in Palestine, Israel. In other words, I recommit tonight to the value of an uncivil university. Thank you.
That was Professor Catherine Franke speaking at the University of Illinois.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.